You have stumbled into a zombie takeout, Philip Gaston. Now, whether you like it or not, you are lost in it with the rest of us.
Hello and welcome to episode 419 of Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we've got a voicemail from Bodo.
John, Scotto, Bodo here. I've been a bad friend. Scotto, I knew about that storm that hit you up there in Chicago. I checked with everybody else because the same storm hit my girl in Ames. She was out without power for 2 days, and I knew you guys got affected, and I forgot to check to see you're okay. I'm glad to see you're okay. John, I'm sorry that I did not check with you about the hurricane. I forgot where you were at, too. Anyway, let's go back in time a little bit. Life Force, or as I call it, Vampires in Space. Not a bad movie. The 9 minutes of exposure was worth it. Patrick Stewart, better than this or Dune? Tough choice. Anyway, I agree with you guys. It's worth about a 4, 4.5. Now, this Rain of Fire. I thought you said Ring of Fire, so I went down a 3-hour time suck with Johnny Cash music, especially in horror movies. It was worth it. Hell of a lot worth it than paying for this Rain of Fire again. I had forgot I had paid for it to go see it in the movie theater. I was mad then. I paid another $3.99. I'm mad again. This movie, I did not care about any of the people, any of the dragons, any of the backstory, any of the history, any of the escalating characters, any of the men, women, children, dragons, deer, birds, this whole world. Did not care. This movie made me not care. They didn't make me care. It was horrible. This is the first movie in the history of the show, this long many years that I've been around, that I've given it zero brains. Gosh, I hope I never get suckered in watching this kid. Anyway, you guys are the best. Love you guys. Keep up the great work. Peace out.
No worries about forgetting where I'm at, Bodo. It's not like I announce it almost every time I introduce myself at the beginning of a show.
Do you?
No, I'm kind of fucking with you.
Oh.
So yeah, no worries about that.
I was thinking of making that my thing, and then I decided not to. Okay. I don't know.
I kind of felt we're making that joke because you didn't do it this week. Patrick Stewart. As far as performances, I'm going to go with Dune because he's in more of it. But he was not right for Gurney Halleck, so I think he fit.
No, not at all.
No, I think he fit Life Force better. The Johnny Cash time suck sounds good. Certainly better than Ring of Fire. And even I liked it a lot more than you did. So of the three of us, you liked it the most. That's weird.
I did. And you see, we should have went with the Johnny Cash reference for the title. Yeah, yeah.
Scott had a Johnny Cash reference for a title that week. All right, but I also had some tweets at Zombie Takeout. How did the dragons multiply? Were they born pregnant? You mentioned they killed off the dinosaurs. Man, like the man said, nature will find a way. And I think they established that the male dragon flies around the world and fertilizes all the eggs. That's why they had to kill the male.
He's kind of like James Brown at the end of the show where they had to put the cape back on him.
Right.
He's ready to just collapse.
Right. And he also tweeted, Lady Hawk, I made it 20 minutes in and could not stand anymore. Hope you guys enjoyed it better. And one more thing before we get to the movie. In the outtake we both saw Bill and Ted Face the Music over the weekend, so we'll be discussing that in the outtake. If you haven't seen it, stop after, you know, there you are, or if you want to hear that last little bit of Steel Toccata, but stop there if you haven't seen Bill and Ted and you have any interest in seeing it, because you do want to go into this, you know, without knowing much. right, on to this week's movie, which is from 1985, Lady Hawk, continuing our fantasy trilogy. And of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Internal Monologues. There's a reason they're internal, and they should probably stay that way.
And also brought to you by Soundtracks. What works for an aerobics video should not be used for a fantasy action movie.
I knew that music sounded familiar. I just couldn't place it until I heard that.
Well, you see, it was in the style of I Felt. I think they were trying to go for an Errol Flynn, you know, pastiche, but instead, it was actually Alan Parsons that did it, too.
Well, no, I think he was the music director. The composer was, I want to say, Andrew Powell, someone who's collaborated with Parsons quite a bit, worked on a lot of Parsons project stuff.
So because they spent all that money, they were just blasting this soundtrack, whether it fit the mood or not.
It never fit the mood.
No, it didn't. But anyway, we have a thief who is making his great escape. No one ever escaped from Stalag 13 or this or whatever this town ran by this Bishop Aquila, my friend.
Aquila, they call it, which apparently is a Latin for eagle. My one bit of trivia, and this caught my attention because there's a brand of ukulele strings spelled the same way, A-Q-U-I-L-A, and I've heard Aquila, Aquila, I've heard a billion pronunciations for that word.
Well, I saw the Archbishop sitting on a park bench, and he was eyeing girls with bad intent.
They say it a lot like Aqualung in the movie for some reason.
That's who should have been doing the fucking soundtrack to this. Oh, you God, get another fucking Ian Anderson, and that's it.
Oh, this would be, I don't care what happened in the movie, if this was a tall soundtrack, it would be at least a 4.5.
Yeah.
You just gave me an idea for sequels and remakes.
There you go. We have this thief who is making his escape, and spoiler alert, he is successful. he does the impossible and gets out of the through the sewer system, makes his way out, and as he's out on the countryside, he gets caught because they were really looking for him and wanted to make an example of him. However, he has the good fortune of running into, a bigger felon in the word of the town, a former captain of the guard, played by Rutger Hauer, of course. And he decides to save this thief who has escaped and they were going to bring back. And winds up killing a bunch of guards and sending them on their way.
Now, well, he doesn't send the ones he killed on their way.
Yeah, he chases them off or whatever. Yeah. I'm wondering, like, well, why is he going back to the town when he doesn't have any success, the captain of the guard, to tell, you know, the bishop what was going on? And then it was, this is a much bigger problem than just the stupid thief. This dude is back.
I kind of wondered why they were expending all of this energy on a random thief, and then apparently this prison has this reputation that nobody has escaped it.
Right. So he is, you know, Archbishop Colonel Klink, and, you know, this is Hogan's Heroes. But anyway, so the thief is traveling with this swordsman who is, I guess, outlaw, you know, former guard captain himself, but he's got this hawk that's with him. Keep thinking of the Falconer from Saturday Night Live. And I think that's where they got the idea from this, you know, for that skit, the Falconer. However, it's one of these Clark Kent Superman things. When night falls, the swordsman disappears, and this woman is just there. And luckily, that only happens a couple times where they're like, what is this? I don't know what's going on. Because it's like, if you've seen this before, it's like, it's too just so fucking obvious.
It's less of a Clark Kent Superman thing, more of a reluctant druid thing.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. So yes, the deal is they were lovers. And they had a curse placed on them that one would be a hawk by day, and the other one would be a wolf at night, and the two shall never be human together forever. Or, you know, or the end of the movie, of course. Oh, yeah. shit, you know? So there's a way to beat this curse, of course, that there are some days where it's not day, just because it's an eclipse.
Yeah. Apparently, they had never had an eclipse at this point.
It was kind of like a V'ger thing. Like, yes, a fucking eclipse. Okay. How is this possible? Like, great. But, you know, they're not all astronomers. You got it's understandable.
Well, we'll get into that in the actual review, but
but of course, Rutger Hauer wants to just fucking kill the guy. And so he just wants to attack, and even comes up with a suicide plan in case his attack doesn't work. And which
yeah,
we'll get into that a little bit. So he confronts him. They have this battle, but then he finally figures out what an eclipse is. And I guess we could say hilarity ensues at this point.
Yeah. And the poppy title music was just, oh, hideous.
Yeah.
I felt dirty. I yes. did like...
You know, I thought when I was listening to that, actually, I had to, like, skip, like, do the 15-second skip thing during the opening credits, because I was like, this is just too awful. Uh-huh. But I was just thinking of last week, like, wow, you thought that soundtrack was bad.
Yeah. I really only had a problem with the one song, but yeah.
I'll take Jimi Hendrix on the nose any day over... Yeah,
right. You know. I'll take the other version of that song before I'll take the title music of this movie.
I wouldn't go that far. Dennis DeYoung is the Antichrist.
Yes. But once the movie got started, I did appreciate the kind of quick cut to the gallows. They kind of catch you off guard with this quick cut to these, you know, bodies falling from a gallows. It starts a lot darker than I was expecting.
Right. And yeah, I guess it does. It sets an odd mood to it because the rest of the movie really isn't all that dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was a little disappointed. Although the music dates it. And then they introduce Broderick's character, Mouse, Matthew Broderick. And he's just doing his Matthew Broderick thing. Which was kind of interesting at first. It added some nice comic relief to this otherwise very serious movie. But then it just...
Got to be too much. I see there is no difference between this character and Ferris Bueller.
And every other character Matthew Broderick has played.
Ferris Bueller has the fourth wall narrative too.
Well, yeah. He doesn't really break the fourth wall in this, per se. I mean,
he's talking to God.
That's a thing in Ferris Bueller, where he deliberately breaks the fourth wall. Mouse never looks at the camera. He's talking to God. So, you know, it could be argued that it's a little bit fourth wall breaking, but not in the same way as Ferris Bueller.
But the accent. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Oh, you know, I mean, he did not have the accent down.
Was he even trying? It just sounded like a normal Matthew Broderick thing.
I could tell you exactly what happened without reading any trivia or anything behind this, just from watching the movie last night. The director wanted him to sound a little British.
Mm-hmm.
He tried in the first scene.
Okay, yeah.
But then when he actually had to do stuff and, like, talk at the same time, and, like, escape from the prison... It was ridiculous and too hard for him to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a while, he dropped it. And then they had him try to pick it up again in like another scene, but he just couldn't hold on to it. Yeah. And then from there on out, he just spoke in, you know, Biloxi blues, you know.
I always thought Broderick was a pretty damn good actor until watching this and realizing every fucking character is the same. He always plays the same guy.
Well, this is around this like a year before Ferris Bueller.
Mm-hmm. That horrible Godzilla movie, Ferris Bueller, it Biloxi Blues, it's always the same guy.
In fact, I would like to see this recut with the Ferris Bueller soundtrack.
Yes.
Like when he's trying to like sneak out, you know, the chicka, you know.
Yeah.
And of course Mouse gets caught when he's, because he decides to mouth off. He finds this little village and, you know, he goes to a bar and says, you know, I'll buy everyone a drink, or drinks around me for the person who wants to, you know, drink with me, because I just escaped from the unescapable prison. And, you know, the guard comes up. And he runs away, you know, after Howard saves his life. And it looks like he's walking down a paved road. Like asphalt paved.
You know, I didn't notice that. But
I mean, it might have just been a dirt road, but it looked like asphalt. I did like the contrast between Broderick and Howard at first.
Because, yeah,
you know, Howard is always Howard, of course.
Yes.
And I'm guessing it's set in... Well, I don't know where it would be set, because Aquila doesn't sound English.
I was thinking France, of course.
Well, that would make sense with, you know, Gaston, Philippe Gaston.
You're right.
But, you know, Howard is doing his normal, you know, very slight Dutch accent, because
he
was from the Netherlands. Michelle Pfeiffer wasn't really trying anything.
No. And that's what you do. If you can't pull the accent off,
right,
don't bother with the accent. There's no need for it.
Right. And everybody else was pretty much British.
Right. They're not going to be speaking English anyway. They should be speaking French.
Right.
But we can forgive that. But, I mean, why have a British accent if it's not even in England?
I got to say, the intermittent slow motion was getting on my nerves. Like, every once in a while, they would slow-mo a scene. It was just that cliche 80s thing.
Yeah, and the cheat for the camera, you know, the creature change.
Right.
Which they obviously did not have the budget to do, like, a manimal,
right,
you know, change.
Thankfully. And when, you know, the wolf suddenly shows up, and then Navarre... Right, Howard's character is gone. You know, when she suddenly shows up and the hawk is gone, it's pretty obvious what's happening.
Yeah.
But they still make you wait like 10 minutes before they fully explain it.
Right. It's another V'ger.
Yeah, yeah.
We're just like, get on with it.
And at that half hour in, I was getting tired of Broderick's, you know, internal monologue shtick. And I say internal in quotes. Also, when the hawk got shot with the crossbow, the arrow that was sticking in the hawk looked a lot smaller than the arrow that was sticking in Isabeau when she turned back into human.
Yeah, should there be like a size adjustment? Like,
yeah.
The arrow grew with her? I don't understand anything.
I did like the bishop's connection to her when it was being pulled out, though. Because he's in pain as well. He's, like, feeling the same pain that she's feeling. You know, the guy who cursed them.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, he cursed them because he wanted her and she was into Navarre and not him. And so, you know,
right.
If I can't have you, no one can, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, there was a sort of a thing about toxic masculinity here way before that was even a coined term, isn't there?
And, you know, first... And well, it's the bishop who's the villain, of course. But then there's Howard. There's also Broderick. There's a scene where, you know, because, you know, Howard and Pfeiffer's characters, Kick, Isabeau and Navarre can't communicate because they're one is human, one's an animal. Broderick is the go-between. And Mouse. And one scene, she basically asks, you know, what did he say, you know, before he turned? And he said, you're to listen to everything I say and do exactly what I tell you. Mouse told this to her. Kind of like using her in a weird way. And then he has her dance with him. That was just a weird scene.
That was weird. But I wouldn't say what
Gaston was a toxic
masculine thing. You know, I think he stayed hoping to have a shot with her, of course. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, he was still a gentleman, actually.
Oh, yeah. No, it was just the whole, you know, you're to do everything I say bit that just rubbed me the wrong way.
I think he was trying to make sure nothing happened to her. Probably out of fear of
Devar. Of Nefar killing him, yeah.
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
okay.
I think that was a very realistic fear.
The really problematic part from Nefar came at the end, or toward the end.
Well, right. The whole thing of just not listening to anybody, like, dude, we have a way for this whole thing to go away. And just ignoring all of that. And then to even have, like, a suicide plot.
He tells this monk who is with them, who is kind of traveling with them, the one who had the prophecy of how to, you know, break the curse, that if his plan fails, the monk is to kill the hawk.
And actually, to do it, like, as soon as you hear the bells, that means...
As soon as you know I failed, kill her. Yeah, and
not
it's,
like,
it's...
let's see what happened first or anything. No, as soon as this goes to shit, just kill her now.
Yeah.
What?
Another, you know, if I can't have her, no one can.
Well, pretty much. Exactly. He was no different from the Archbishop. Right.
Also, another thing that struck me in this movie is Roderick does not seem comfortable in fantasy fiction.
No, this is definitely out of his wheelhouse. Yeah. Are you kidding?
I mentioned the monk. Imperius is his name. I have it here.
Yeah.
Easily the best part of the movie.
Definitely. Well, Hauer. I love Hauer.
Hauer's always fun, but I just got a kick out of Imperius. I loved him kind of leading the guards through this booby-trapped castle.
I mean, they were so close to having an actual, you know, Dungeons and Dragons party assembled. You know, the healer, the thief, and the swordsman.
Right.
And instead, they kind of kept them all at a distance from each other.
Right. Well, because it wasn't a quest movie.
It could have been, though. I mean, the quest was to break the curse.
Well, but that didn't really become a... It was kind of... They brought the party together.
Yeah.
And then they spent, like, the entire second act trying to convince Hauer to go on the quest.
Right, he had a revenge quest that he wanted to do, and I don't understand the point of stealing the sword either. I mean, he just had another sword anyway. And, right, and they had to convince him that this would work rather than his revenge quest.
And it was pretty obvious from, again, a 2020 standpoint that when Imperius said there's a time when it's not day and not night, you know, that they're talking about an eclipse. And even if they didn't have the word, even if they didn't have a scientific understanding of what an eclipse is, if it had ever happened before, you would think that they would know it as a thing, and that's what he's talking about.
True. I mean, technically, isn't it still daytime under an eclipse?
But it's not late, and they were conflating nighttime and daytime and whether it's late or dark.
Okay.
You know, the time of day doesn't actually change. It's just the light level in a particular part of the world that the sun happens to be facing at that time. But, you know.
Like, I'm pretty sure the last time we had that big solar eclipse, I was at work, so I'm pretty sure it was daytime.
Right, of course. And, you know, it was light again, like, 2 minutes later.
Yeah. Although, honestly, the eclipses last a really fucking long time in real life, as opposed to this movie where it was, like, 2 minutes. Oh, it's an eclipse!
I'm being facetious when I say 2 minutes, but they don't last that long. Like, maybe 5-10 minutes, the ones I've seen.
It takes forever for it to travel,
to
reach peak,
right,
and then to...
Well, I mean, like, the full darkness is, like, maybe 10, 15. But you would think that they would...
Right. The peak actually only lasts for so long, but it takes forever for it to get to that,
that
eclipse is happening.
Because giant bodies move very slowly, at least from a distance.
Right. And then to have the perfectly, you know, bashed hole in the stained glass window for the eclipse to be seen through. I was like, oh my god. So 80s.
I can't complain about conveniences like that because I'm a Star Wars fan and the original trilogy is built on conveniences. Let's be honest. Also, why would Mouse tell Isabeau in human form that hawk is his favorite thing to eat. Oh, I'm sorry, in hawk form. She was in hawk form. And he's talking to her, wondering if she can understand him. And he's saying, like, he used to love to eat hawk.
That just seems like it is in bad taste.
It's like, literally. Like, yeah, I would eat you if it weren't for that guy who's going to kill me if I do. Which is kind of what he implies in a different sense in other parts of the movie.
Did you catch who the trapper
was? Just getting to that. Cesar was Alfred Molina. Did not recognize him until I saw the credits.
A super young Alfred Molina.
Yeah, I went back and like, oh yeah, that was him.
I was like, that guy looks familiar.
Did like the Ice Lake Rescue, but the music got way too loud and was just way more intense than the actual scene.
Yes.
Like, the music was like blasting out the dialogue. It didn't make sense.
They spent so much money on the soundtrack. I mean, to get Alan Parson, of course. Mm-hmm. They had to pay him a ton, probably.
I'm just thinking how much Richard Simmons would have loved to have this soundtrack back in the day. And the Eclipse...
We could, I mean, not just the soundtrack. We should get the cast of Ferris Bueller, you know, Rooney to play the Archbishop and Cameron to play Navarre.
And when we actually get to the Eclipse, it's just hilariously bad looking.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not like early bad CG. It was just this cutout of the moon that was just way too detailed. Yes. Moving in front of the sun.
In this perfect, you know, lineup of the pole and the window. It was just, what were they thinking?
I did like the trick that Navarre used to kill Marquette, the guard who was chasing him. They end up dueling before he confronts the bishop. And he's, Navarre is on the ground, kind of rolling out of the way of stabs from Marquette's sword. Sword ends up behind him. He just rolls on it. Yes. Takes it out of his hand, rolls over it, picks it up, and put, you know, jabs him in the stomach.
That was amazing and worthy of slow motion too.
Yeah, that one
was. Unlike a lot of other shots, if they didn't do that in slow motion, I'd be like, wait a minute, how the fuck did he lose his upper hand so quickly?
Yeah. That was the one good use of slow motion. You're right. I did think something bigger and more pyrotechnic was going to happen when the curse was broken.
Yeah, it's true. And rather than just Imperius going, that's done.
Because they're confronting him. They're both, Navarre is about to kill him. Isabel walks in. They're both there in human form. It looked like
a little bit of a light or something maybe coming out of them, or I don't know.
It looked like the bishop was smoking a little bit. And I don't mean smoking a cigarette. It looked like smoke was actually rising from him. But he just kind of looks and sits there horrified. And, you know, he doesn't, like, turn to stone. There's no pyrotechnics. There's no, you know, light shining from anywhere aside from the hole in the window once the sun comes back. It's just this, it's just Imperius saying, well, that's done. It's broken.
Ah, yeah. So much for that. And you know, it was a curse that it had its time, you know.
And just when I think I'm free of the pointless romantic subplot, because I mean the romance was the point of the movie.
I was going to say, wait a minute, this is the subplot.
I'm not complaining about Navarre and Isabeau. That's, I have no problem with a romance being front and center in a film, but at the very end, Mouse and Imperius.
You think they had?
They get the kiss and they walk away holding hands, and I'm kidding.
And Imperius, wait a minute. Oh.
Mouse and Imperius were kind of chummy at the end.
I thought I snoozed a little bit.
They were kind of chummy at the end. It was weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, the two sidekicks.
Yeah. Sequels and remakes?
Sequels and remakes.
I actually would like to see a serious remake of this with a better cast and a tolerable score. You mentioned Ian Anderson. He's fucking perfect for it.
Of course. You know, I didn't have that much of a problem with the cast in this, honestly.
I like Howard.
Although, I almost called Broderick Bueller.
Cast-wise, the only real issue I have cast-wise is Matthew Broderick.
I think the problem lies in the director of this film more than anything else. did not seem to know what the fuck he was doing.
But yeah, I would like to see a better remake with, you know, a actor playing Mouse who, you know, doesn't monologue all the time and is comfortable doing fantasy. I'd love to
see Steve Buscemi or, you know, somebody like that, dude. You know.
Well, in that role, he's too old for it now. Unless you do go older with the thief.
Yeah, the thief doesn't have to be a kid.
That's true. He'd be perfect. Because I could see him in that kind of role.
Yeah.
I don't know who you'd cast as the big hulking, you know, hero guy. Vin Diesel.
John Cena.
Diesel would be perfect, actually. Because Diesel can act.
Can he?
Watch the Pitch Black movies. He's actually pretty good. And he kind of fits the role. I would love to cast someone from this in the remake, but there are no real...
I've seen it because he's a bit younger, you know, and he can...
Yeah, okay. If he can act, yeah.
Like probably just as good as Diesel.
I don't know who... There are no important female characters aside from Isabeau, so I don't know... So Michelle Pfeiffer, you wouldn't want to cast in anything. Howard's no longer with us.
Bueller's girlfriend's name, but that's who I'd have in my Ferris Bueller remake of this.
Well, I mean, if we're doing that, I mean, like a serious remake. I guess Bueller is Broderick is Imperius, maybe, but he would become Magic Max.
That would be a nice touch to put Broderick in as Imperius.
He's really the only one who's left. Who you could? I just is it Princess Bride? Is it Magic Max?
Oh,
I feel like he would do that with the role.
Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
It was a very Princess Bride moment of like, you know, you killed the hawk,
right? I guess he would work in that role. Anyway, on to Brains.
On to Brains.
I was kind of at a 3, but I had to take it down for the misogyny, and of course the music took a half a brain, so I'm going to.
Let's see. I'm going to stick with the 3, because, I mean, I liked the cast mostly. Of course, Hauer. Hated the soundtrack, which just absolutely stomped over everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very clumsy directing. Yeah. So, yeah. But it's still, like, an enjoyable movie, I thought. I don't know why it would be, like, a 20-minute turn-off kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it was maybe... I checked what was going on at 20 minutes after, because I'd read that tweet. It was mostly just the prison escape. So
like,
I think
Hawk
he just...
the Slayer, if I remember right, had, like, a really weird 80s sound, right, synth soundtrack, too. I think what do we call it, like, disco horseback riding, because, like, every scene they were riding horseback had this, like, like, synth music.
I suspect...
It wasn't nearly as annoying as this was.
I suspect Bodo was put off by the title theme, the title music, and Matthew Broderick's monologue.
You know, if you made it through that title sequence, you might as well stick with the rest of them.
But, yeah, you've paid your dues.
So I'm going 3.
Okay, what have we learned?
Medieval life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
And I learned that Matthew Broderick should never do medieval fantasy ever again.
No.
All right, that's it for Lady Hawk. Until next time, we'll be concluding this trilogy with Labyrinth. Hopefully it's better than the last two.
You know what? I don't know if I've ever made it through the entire movie of Labyrinth. It was kind of a kid's movie back in the day, and it was kind of like,
I know many, many people who will be very mad at me for saying this, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, I don't think I've never made it from beginning to end.
I've never seen it at all. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.
So we stopped recording about 20 minutes ago.
Oh, at least.
And just realized we'd never recorded the Bill and Ted mini review. We both saw Bill and Ted over the weekend. I fucking loved it.
Yes, same here. When's the last time you've seen the others?
Oh, probably shortly after they were in theaters.
Because Mrs. Scotto had never seen... Even the first one, which was kind of like a whoa. The second one, of course, is kind of an odd duck, the second one.
Station.
I mean, there's like a lot of neat little things that they throw out in there, yeah. But as a movie, as a whole, a lot of it doesn't really work.
They had a lot of ideas that they tried to cram in.
And it's very lazily produced also, yeah. Directed.
But like it introduces death.
The scene at the end when they're supposed to be playing their final concert is like some of the worst pantomiming of instrument playing. And this is even comparison to like MTV days.
Yeah.
They totally weren't playing, you know?
Which is surprising because I actually was watching that scene, the post-credit scene in Face the Music, and thinking, I wonder if they actually play guitar. Because, I mean, they obviously weren't actually playing the thing.
But right.
From their hand motions, it looked like they actually play. Then I remembered, Keanu Reeves plays bass in Dogstar. So probably also plays guitar. And then I was watching an interview. They really bonded. They're actually really close IRL. They bonded over when they went to the audition for the first movie and found out one of the things is they both play bass. They both drove a motorcycle. They both play bass. Similar taste in theater. Blah, blah, blah. They really bonded.
When you watch the second one and then watch this one, it's like, wow, this is so much better.
Mm-hmm. There were two parts at the beginning where I knew I was in. When we find out, again, this is full spoilers, they named their daughters after each other.
Well, they do. They introduce the kids at the end of the second one.
Oh, they do. Okay, I forgot about that.
It's a really weird thing at the end because they're supposed to play this big concert at the end of the second one, and they're all set to go, but they realize they suck. They never learned how to play instruments. Uh-huh. So what they did was they go back in time to learn to play,
right. And
then when they come back with their wives and everything, like one's got like a long beard and the other's, you know, they both have babies. They introduce them as Bill and Ted.
Okay, but now we find out they're actually female versions.
Yeah,
Bill's daughter is Thea, Ted's daughter is Wilhelmina, and then we get the song they play at the wedding. Which is just fucking brilliant. Pulling out every obscure instrument, starting with the theremin, and then just pulling out every obscure instrument you can think of. It's this amazing, like, world music prog thing.
Yes, I knew I was in when I saw that too.
It's like, okay, this is why they never made it. They're damn good musicians, but they're playing prog.
Right. And that's never going to bring the world together, unfortunately.
And then Kristen Schaal is the new Rufus, took the place of Rufus. And I love Kristen Schaal. So
I do too. I think she's a good choice. I mean, I wouldn't have mind seeing Dave Attell as Rufus's son, but Kristen Schaal works well too.
Yeah. And the daughters, particularly Billy, was really just doing an impression, but they did so well.
They did. They had all the movements down. Yeah. When one of them did like the little head shake, I was like, "Oh my god, that is so perfect."
And then it's kind of a dual quest. There is kind of a romantic subplot, but it's saving a marriage, so okay, it's already an existing relationship. The Bill and Ted are basically off trying to find the song to basically steal from themselves to learn the song that's going to save the world. Or save reality in this version.
I loved them going through different points of their older life.
Mm-hmm.
Or lives, sorry. Because, yeah, yeah. I mean, they are pretty much living one life.
Yeah. And basically, in one version, they try the alternate universe versions of Bill and Ted hate the originals because they ended their marriage.
Right.
And then we get another one who basically try to sell them a Dave, try to not sell them, try to pass off a Dave Grohl song as their own to just kind of get out of it.
I mean, he's no Sir James Martin, but right. Yeah, I mean, he could accept a cameo from Dave Grohl.
Uh-huh. But then the daughters go on the quest to put the band together.
Yes.
Hendrix, great impression of Hendrix, great impression
It's sort of the first plot of the first one,
right,
where
yeah.
we have a project to finish. Let's get the best people from history to come forward and help us out here.
They start with Hendrix. They find out, well, Hendrix won't do it, but he loves Louis Armstrong, so they get Louis Armstrong and bring him in, and that brings Hendrix in. And then they get Mozart. They're watching Mozart playing at this gathering. And Hendrix somehow finds an amplifier. He's standing there with the strap, looks around, takes a cable, somehow has a guitar cable, walks behind a thing. I don't think it was the pod that they showed up in. I think it was just a bit of scenery. Plugs it in. Apparently there's an amp there.
I imagine Jimi Hendrix had access to amps wherever he went.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Wherever in time.
Yeah.
The Chinese musician, I want to say Ling Long, the inventor of modern or of classical Chinese music, actual person, invented the wooden flute.
Cool.
Yeah, that was interesting. And then the drummer, Draga, I think, or Drog. I loved how she had a kit made out of like stones. Like an actual drum kit made out of like stones and shit and pots. And the twist at the end was predictable, but I liked it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could kind of see that coming from a mile away.
It was a different Logan in Preston.
Yeah.
Oh, and what was his name, the robot?
Oh, my God.
Dennis.
Dennis
stole the fucking movie. You think Death is going to steal it, but then Dennis. I thought it was the same actor, too. When I first saw Dennis, I thought it was the actor. I thought it was William Sadler who played Death. They look quite a bit alike.
A.K.A. Sloan from Deep Space Nine.
Right. But he starts off as this killer robot who the future send out because they don't think Bill and Ted are going to do the job. And they fail. The robot sends them to hell just as they get the song.
And so then, really, the robot succeeds.
Yeah.
But it's not, I mean, it's a failure.
Just as they were about to save the world, he kills them. And then the robot kills himself to give them the song in hell. And he goes from this silent killer assassin to this really neurotic kind of just average guy, everyman.
I mean, kind of taking a little bit of Marvin.
Yeah, a little bit of Marvin, yeah.
The paranoid android.
But it's not even paranoid. It's just kind of, I'm Dennis. Dennis Caleb McCoy, that was it.
Right.
He always introduces himself with his full name. And he just talks everybody's ear off. It's, if you remember the Animaniacs sketch, the guy at the party who just talked Yakko's ear off. He's that guy. And it's just this incredibly annoying but endearing character as this robot in the middle of a movie that really has nothing to do with him.
Right.
They just throw so much at you. I've heard it compared to a lot to Men in Black as well. Because of the way it's cut and the design of the future. I love the first Men in Black, so.
Yeah, the first Men in Black was not bad.
So, I mean, that's a reasonable comparison, and it's fair, and it's fine.
Yeah.
But there's nothing unpredictable, per se, but it's I mean, Dennis aside, it's very predictable. You knew Death was coming back. The ending is very predictable. It's just brilliantly done.
I loved the behind-the-music thing with Death, though, The stardom just got to him. I mean, they kind of insinuate this at the end of the second one, uh-huh, that they have a thing against each other,
right,
in headlines. You know, Death wins the Indy 500.
Because you need the behind the music moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, they kind of played that out with, Death left the band, did a bunch of solo albums.
Right.
And the girls save the day not because they're musicians, but because they listen to a lot of music. And so they can play a little bit of this, play a little bit of that, and kind of direct the band to kind of play bits and pieces of their existing music. And I loved them handing out, Bill and Ted kind of double themselves and, fuck with time so they can hand an instrument to literally everyone in the world.
That's always been my favorite part of all three of these movies, is how there's no respect for the space-time continuum.
There's no respect for the space-time continuum. There's no respect for logic.
Right. I've always loved that about this, how it's not like, oh, you can't meet yourself or anything like that. No, no. From the very beginning, they were all just like, hey, future Bill and Ted, you know, like the very first one.
Well, technically, the same matter can't exist in time at the same place without destroying reality. It's not technically the same matter.
Yeah, but you know what? None of that's actually proven because it happens.
Right, it's impossible to prove that because we don't have time travel.
Right.
But also, they didn't necessarily break that rule because every cell in your body replenishes like within like 7 days. So it's not really the same matter. I was thinking about that. Because I nitpick science. Thought. So, you know, Bill and Ted from another timeline are not the same Bill and Ted physically. Different matter.
I don't know how far apart they were in the first one where they come back and meet Rufus in the Circle K parking lot.
Right.
It's probably only a few hours, honestly. Yeah. So I don't think that stands where their cells have been replaced by that much, because everything happens in the same day in the first one.
But I'm talking about like the burnt out other versions of Bill and Ted after the marriages have ended.
Oh, those are years apart. Yeah. Yeah,
those guys have been through some shit. And those are the ones they actually like shook hands with and touched.
Yeah.
So that's where that would have been an issue. The other ones they just observed from a distance. So there would have to be a contact. And one of them actually hugged their their other version. it was just genius. The other thing I love about Bill and Ted that I forgot about, and the reason I want to go back and visit or revisit them, they're just so hopeful. They're just, Bill and Ted are the eternal optimists.
The first one is really brilliant. Just the whole Napoleon Bonaparte going to the Waterloo Water Park.
Yeah.
And just, you know, shoving kids out of the way so he can get on the water slide. And then he comes up with his strategy to invade Russia. and in their history presentation, he lays it out there. And, you know, Keanu Reeves is just like looking at it going, I don't think it's going to work. And then he just gets angry and smashes the board. Using a risk board, by the way, to demonstrate his strategy. Yeah.
But of course, you know, when they get to the song at the end, when, you know, everybody in the world has an instrument, I of course had to grab my ukulele and figure out the chord changes. Play along.
Did you see the Weird Al?
I've read about the Weird Al cameo at the end. I didn't see it.
Playing at the end, yeah.
Because the closing credits, there is like a billion screens on the screen of different famous people playing along with the song. But yeah, I missed most of them. It was Weird Al and somebody else. Who Weird Al was playing an accordion. The other person was like air guitaring. But yeah, definitely get a chance to see it if you can, you know, spare the $20 on Amazon.
Yeah, my brother-in-law got it. He's got his movie theater set up, and so we saw it on the big screen.
Yeah, I just watched it on my 4K, you know, 27-inch Mac. All right, so like I said, highly recommend it. Talk to you later.